David Morata joins us on the program regularly. You read him in the business section of the daily newspaper on Mondays. Always terrific columns and terrific financial advice as well for people who really, I think, in this day and age have very little idea on their own what they ought to be doing. Here's a man who's dedicated his life to studying that, understanding it, and giving what I think is very informed advice. David Morata, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. We've got a lot on our plate today because things keep changing. And I guess in some ways, the more they change, the more they stay the same. We're going to be talking about the Social Security tax cuts, a gift from our government to us, if you want to put it that way. And also, if you're able to save that money, we'll talk a little later about where you should put it and how you should use it. So let's talk about the Social Security payroll tax. I have a feeling a lot of people are very confused about payroll taxes in general. They don't understand who's paying them and how much they are. So let's start off with who's paying this tax and what is the amount?
Yeah, it's amazing that people may not even know that there's been a Social Security payroll tax cut this year. It sort of passes almost unnoticed. The correct figure for what you get taxed is you get taxed 12.4% for Social Security plus an additional 2.9% for Medicare, a total of 15.3%. Of the 12.4%, 6.2% is deducted from the employee's paycheck, and the other 6.2% is withheld from the employer, who therefore reduces salaries accordingly. The true answer is that a company would pay you a certain amount, and they don't care what the cost that you get is. They don't care what the pay that you get is. They only care what the cost is to them. So they take your salary and all of your benefits and all of the payroll taxes, and they add it all together, and they say, are you worth that amount? Mm-hmm. And then they either hire you or you don't. So in essence, without all of these taxes, employers would be willing to pay another 15.3% into your pocket. And so the entire amount, in essence, comes out of the employee's paycheck. And what's happened this year is the 6.2% that's deducted from the employee's paycheck has been reduced for just 1 year to 4.2%. So you should have an extra 2% in your paycheck. So if you make $50,000 a year, you should have an extra $1,000 in your paycheck this year. And the question is, what should you do with that, or should you do anything with that, and how does that affect your retirement?
All righty. So we talk about 6.2 to 4.2. Now, what is the rationale, the expressed rationale behind this? Why did the president and those in the United States Congress agree to this?
The United Auto Workers supported it with what I think is the most straightforward approach. They said working families will likely spend this money in their local communities, creating jobs and stimulating overall growth. So
they're
hoping that y'all spend this money. So they're hoping with $1,000, y'all go out and buy three more iPods or other goods.
Here's what's fascinating to me. And I saw the same hypocrisy in some of the other issues with the extension of the tax cuts, but only on a temporary basis, is if this is such a great idea, if this is going to stimulate the economy and cause more jobs, then why is it only for 1 year? I mean, it's either a good idea or it's not. There's nothing magical about this period. So do we have any explanation or rationale for that?
No, other than they know that there's a burden on workers and there's low employment, there's high unemployment, and so they're just trying to find some financial fix that will make the hurting stop for people and keep them in office. Because when there's trouble in the economy, that's the most likely time for people to vote politicians out of office. Politicians, it turns out, do the most harm when we have a great economy. And they take all of the tax revenue and they spend it. So we would actually like to keep the congressman hurting rather than helping, because when we're happy and we're not watching things is when they do the most harm.
And there's certainly been a lot of that. We're talking with David Morata, and we've got just about a minute left here. Now, there are some people who don't pay any Social Security payroll taxes, or does everybody pay that tax, and is there some sort of a limit?
There is a limit. It's $100,000+, so that the most you can receive is $2,136 for your tax rebate, and that's if you earn about $110,000-$120,000. There's an upper limit to that. 150 million workers are going to receive this. It's going to cost the government, if you will, the Social Security taxes, $112 billion. And that's a tremendous amount to take out of a system which is already insolvent. The Treasury, one of the White House economic advisors said the payroll tax will have absolutely no effect on the solvency of Social Security. And he said this because they're going to replace all of that with Treasury bills. In other words, they're going to give Social Security a bigger stack of IOUs.
Just what we needed, more IOUs. Can't wait. All righty, you can take that to the bank. David Murata is our guest. He's online at emurata.com. We have lines open for you if you have comments or questions. 977-1070 is the phone number. We want you to join us, and all points of view are welcome. Maybe you'd like to take issue with us. We love that as well. All righty, we're heading into the news break. Head over to the 24-hour local news center. The Shilling Show back with David Murata right after this. Guests, opinions, analysis, commentary, and insight unique to the Central Virginia media market right here on The Shilling Show. And now with people listening across the country via podcast, if you hear a show, and I talk to so many people who go, oh, I had to walk out right at the punchline. Well, you know, you can go back and listen to these broadcasts later. Just go to shillingshow.com. There is a podcast button at the top of the page. It'll take you to the page you need to go to, and then you just scroll down to find what you're looking for. You can save them, share them with your friends, or listen right there online on your computer. So we appreciate that. It's a free service of The Shilling Show and WINA. David Murata joins us. We're talking about the Social Security payroll tax cut. It was 2%. Actually works out to roughly a third of the taxes. Well, maybe a sixth if you figure that the employer who's not really paying your taxes, that would be money in your pocket, as David pointed out for us. We had a caller, Tim, off the air, who was talking about, you know, we ought to be looking at politicians with disdain and keeping a very careful eye on them at all times. And I think Tim made a good point. Do you agree with that?
Definitely. His comment was with suspicion and disdain constantly. Yes. President Bush tried the exact same gimmick back in 2008, 3 years ago. He was issuing tax rebates, if you remember, in the form of stimulus checks. And I responded just as vehemently that was an insult, a cheap insult directed at the American people and the free markets. Every time the government bureaucracy engages in some kind of centralized spending plans, the economy's weakened. They believe they're better off, but workers who take that money and that stimulus check and then go out and spend it, or take this rebate and go out and spend it, are actually dropping behind on their savings toward retirement.
And we talked about this before. It was in context of these rebate checks when they came, because you said, you know, if people go out and buy a big ticket item, they could actually be putting themselves in the hole, thinking that they're ahead of things, right?
Yeah. Take me, for example. I'm 50 years old. By the time you're 50, you should have saved about 10 times your annual standard of living. So if I spend an extra $1,000, let's say I get the $1,000 more for my 2%. If I spend that $1,000, that means I've increased my standard of living by $1,000. That means I need $10,000 more in savings, because I should have saved 10 times my standard of living. So increasing your standard of living means I've got 10 times that amount. I've dropped behind on my savings. And so the correct answer is, when you get a windfall like this, that you can spend about 4% of it, and the other 96% ought to be going into your savings. Because you can't, a windfall like this, you can't keep up every year. So it's not like I have this $1,000 to be saving every single year. It's just a one-time event. And it's the reason why these one-time short-term tax cuts or extension of tax cuts are so debilitating to people's finances, is because they go out and spend them, and then that puts them that much further behind on their retirement savings.
And it's interesting that, you know, you look at the cost of administration of sending out all those checks that happened under the Bush administration, and then some other checks that were sent out more recently under the current administration. And I often wonder why they don't just say, okay, we're going to make a permanent reduction in taxes across the board for everybody or everybody who's paying taxes and call it a day. But instead, they always want to gerrymander, and they want to tweak these things and fine-tune them. And I guess the bottom line word is meddle. Why do they want to meddle? Why can't they just make it simple and inexpensive?
Yeah, and the answer is because they want the credit for it. Uh-huh. They don't want to leave that credit in the private sector. They don't want to leave taxes low and leave it as your money. They want to take it away from you first and then magnanimously give it back to you. Even Obama is now taking credit for the tax cuts that were rolled around where he was simply extending them for 2 years.
And that was not without a big fight.
Right.
And without a lot of cost on the other end. David Murata is our guest, online at emurata.com. You used an interesting term, and I want to go back to this for a second. You talked about the centralized spending plans. And whenever I hear centralized planning, I get nervous because I'm thinking of Red China, and I'm thinking of these 5-year plans, and they were miserable failures. Centralized planning is becoming more common, not only for spending, but for other sorts of things across America.
Yeah, and the genius of Adam Smith and the genius of economics is that a million people in the United States making independent decisions is smarter than any one person. One person cannot know everything that's going on in the economy and what's best for people, but a million people making separate decisions will make the right decisions. And the supply and demand in economics, if you try to fight that, you only get shortages or you get things that are too expensive. So one or the other. So anything that pushes the free markets out of balance by centralized planning and by trying to nudge people in various directions only produces inefficiencies. So the most efficient economy is one in which it's the most free. And those are the ones that are going to have the highest rate of growth. And the only way to get out of our current deficit is to grow out of it. So if we want the American style of 6.5% annual growth, then we need to leave markets as free as possible. If we want the European malaise of 2 or 3% growth, then what we should do is put heavy regulations on energy and healthcare and the financial markets, which is exactly what we've done. And those three sectors are huge, a huge portion of the U.S. economy. The only major portion of the U.S. economy that's left unencumbered, which makes a good investment plan, is right now technology. And can you imagine if the government started to come out with rules about what kind of iPod apps you could and couldn't have, and what kind of browsers and technology you could and couldn't have? Well, actually, it turns out they're trying to do that.
Yes, they are.
They're trying to take control of the internet and put all of this law and legislation on it, to the point of whether or not a browser site can put cookies on your computer or not. I mean, it's ridiculous to try to micromanage technology. I actually think there's many, many sites that are putting cookies on my computer, for which I'm very glad, because I don't see the ads I'm not interested in. I only see the ads that I am interested in, and I can flag stuff as offensive, and they're automatically doing that kind of feedback. So people will visit sites or won't visit sites based upon their preferences, and some of the sites I want to be able to do the things that they're doing.
And the interesting thing is that, you know, if you really don't want the cookies, most of the browsers, everyone that I'm aware of, has a way to prohibit them from being put onto your computer. Now, that comes with a number of drawbacks, things that take extra time. It won't help you remember your passwords. They won't remember what you've purchased before and know about you. But if you really are bothered by that, there's already a way to deal with it. And yet we're looking at creating another huge, I think, government bureaucracy to deal with a problem that doesn't exist.
That's exactly right. And the free market will solve that by having browsers that give you more and more control over what you can and can't do. Mm-hmm. So the free market seems to work. So the answer is that all of us are smarter not centralized planning. All of us are smarter than a few individuals trying to make decisions for everyone.
Well, it's a terrific point of view, but I guess the thing I wanted to ask you is, the people in charge, they don't believe that, or they know that and they think they can do better?
No, they're truly sincere. They truly believe that you're too stupid to make your own decisions, and they have to make decisions for you. Or else they'll say something like, well, Rob, you might be smart enough, but all those other people out there are too stupid. And you have to admit that there are some people out there that are very stupid. And so there is a cost for freedom. The cost for freedom is the ability to do stupid things.
And that's okay.
And that's okay.
And that's also how you learn. I mean, if we look at granting, if we look at child rearing, and my kids are a little behind yours in age, but if we look at that, the way that we make our children independent and free is to allow them to fail occasionally and learn those lessons.
I always say that the most important goal of child rearing is to raise them to the level of equal.
Yes.
Where you are not making decisions for them anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the faster and sooner you can do that, the better you've done it as a parent.
We've got a line open for you right now at 977-1070. Leon, if you could grab line 2 for us, and let's go to Richard, who's on line 1. Hello, Richard. Welcome to The Shilling Show. You're on with David Murata.
Good afternoon, David. And I truly enjoy your guest. My question is, when we look at government, does David Murata believe that they are anywhere near educated in finance of how they're going to control and grow these communities that they're responsible for? Does the Sorensen Institute teach any economics of government? I think that Mr. Marotto might want to grade what happened last night at City Council and just tell us what the acumen of all of these city councilors is.
All right, let's get a response.
No, certainly they're the people who go into government go into it for very, very deep and I think honorable reasons of altruism. But they do at their central core believe that they know better than other people. And if you were to put them in charge and give them absolute power, it would be awful because they would continue to torture us because they thought it was for our good incessantly. And so it's very difficult when someone thinks they're doing something for your good to get them to stop. You know, at least if someone knows that they're torturing you, that at some point they'll just grow tired of it. But if they think it's for your good, they'll never stop. And certainly they're not educated in finance. They don't understand how the world works. They don't understand how finance works. They make basic financial mistakes. And I think the more I think there was another study, the more liberal that they are, of course, then the more they get basic economic questions wrong. And that's a deep problem. And I think it's a problem that the conservative movement in terms of education has to constantly be educating not only the next generation, but you need to be pointing out, as I think Rob does, the insanity of some of the decisions that come out of the city council.
Yeah, it is totally insane. And Richard, I agree with you. There's a tremendous amount of economic and financial incompetence on the city council. The unfortunate part is that these people are continually returned to their seats, or their stewards are returned after the terms are up for the ones who are incumbent. And they continue with these insane policies until the community wakes up and votes them out. There will be no change. Let's go to Greg, who's on the line. Greg, welcome to the Shilling Show. You're on with David Marotta.
Fired up the first go around this morning, but I'd like to just make an analogy. I look at the United States as one great big lake with ice on it. And I look at the government is taking 70% of our money to place sentries around the ice pond because we're too stupid to walk out know whether to walk out on it or not. As far as I'm concerned, you get rid of the sentries, and if you're dumb enough to walk on thin ice, you fall through. And I'll let you go with that.
Thank you very much. Let's get a reply from David before we go to the break.
Yeah, I think it was Robert Heinlein in one of his books who said, you can do your civic duty by going to the polls every time and voting no. because most of the things that government is trying to do are things that are better done by the private sector. And, you know, we can have arguments on the fringes of libertarian as to whether you can, you know, if some of the extreme things can be done like roads at the private sector. But we're so far from that. And there's so many things that are being done now by government that shouldn't be done by government and should be either not done at all or done at the private sector, that I think the conservatives have the upper hand in terms of trying to beat back most of government. Government is the problem. Government does not produce anything, or it doesn't have any gross domestic product value, and it doesn't even contribute anything to taxes. It is simply a drain on the rest of our's welfare. And it plays into all kinds of class envy and politics that way in order to try to pit one group against another. A friend of mine was very impressed from the fact my wife and I had just graduated from college. This is 1982. We were unemployed. We were looking for jobs. But we were in favor of the policies of Ronald Reagan, even though we had every incentive not to be. And he was impressed by that because that's what we need more of. We need more people who are employed by government being against the creep of government and trying to push it back, even though they're employed by government. Because without that, the fragility of freedom is too many people who get their daily sustenance off of government continuing to vote for additional government programs.
And that, my friend, is the end of the republic when that goes too far. David Marotta is our guest. We have a line open for you at 977-1070. Disagree or agree, all points of view welcome here on The Shilling Show, especially yours, and we'll be back right after this. Broadcasting live from Sugartown, also known as Charlottesville, the Democratic Socialist Republic of, David Marotta joins us. We're into the last segment of this hour. Coming up in hour number two, it's Congressman Robert Hurt and also Ken Boyd will be joining us. We have a line open for you at 977-1070. And we want to give the punchline to the discussion because we've talked about how people shouldn't just be taking their quote-unquote windfall and just spending it on things or buying themselves an extra latte every day or whatever they would do with it. There are substantive steps that people should take, and certain accounts that they ought to have set up as a baseline. So let's start with number one.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is this one change is worth the entire difference between being a millionaire and not being a millionaire. In fact, it's the premise of the New York Times bestseller a couple of years ago, The Automatic Millionaire. And that is simply have automated your savings process. What we like to do for clients is have a taxable investment account. And into your taxable investment account, you put all of your paycheck. And then from the taxable investment account, you have a money link that links to your joint checking account. And you transfer monthly whatever you want to spend. So you have a spending plan, you transfer monthly out of your taxable investment account. What that means is if you had all of that in place, when your paycheck goes up by 2%, it automatically stays in your taxable investment account, and the same amount continues to transfer to your joint checking account for your daily expenses. The default of all of your savings is savings and investing, and it stays in that account. So simply changing to have your paycheck put into an investment account and then only transferring what you want to spend leaves the remainder in investments. That one change alone automates becoming a millionaire because you've separated your spending from your paycheck.
Yeah, it's kind of like the government. And I reported yesterday that the state government had an extra $152 million come into the coffers. And what did they do? They didn't give it back to us. They immediately spent it. But that's, I think, the people's propensity is if the money is sitting there in the account, oh, look, there's $500 in that account. Let's go spend it.
It's very difficult to remember to send extra money from your checking account back into your savings account. And it's nigh impossible for the government to say, oh, look, we have an excess. Why don't we send that back into the economy where it's going to do some good and return that to people? But that's the difference between a healthy economy and a not healthy economy, whether it's your family or it's the state legislature.
You say that people should have a joint checking account, but not what they used to call a passbook account or a standard savings account.
Yeah, I don't think there's any value in having a savings account. You should have enough in your joint checking account to cover 2 or 3 months worth of spending, and then you should replenish it once a month. So when it drops down to 2, maybe you replenish it back to 3. But everything else should be in a taxable investment account. And people forget that you can have taxable investments. All of your savings doesn't need to be in 401ks or IRAs or Roth IRAs. Having taxable savings is a way of building real wealth. The capital gains in a taxable savings account are only taxed at 15%. If you save it in your 401k, then when you take it out, it's going to be taxed much higher than 15%. It's going to get taxed at ordinary income tax rates. So it's better to have a taxable savings account in addition to your other accounts because that money can be spent before retirement if needed.
And people also should have, if they qualify, a Roth IRA.
Yeah, a Roth IRA is almost always the right answer, unless you're about to lose a tremendous amount of income and have a very low income period. Your income and your tax rate is only liable to increase going forward, increase either because you make more money or increase because the government just continues to move the brackets up from this point. And they're going to move them up in 2 years. So a Roth IRA puts it in now when your taxes are low, and you can take it out later when your taxes are high, tax-free, and it'll grow tax-free in the meantime. So, in addition to have a joint checking and taxable investment accounts and your 401k or your 403b, having Roth IRA accounts is a great idea. And having these is a great idea primarily because the government gives them certain tax advantages. And anytime you can get a tax advantage, it's worthwhile to put the money in the accounts where it'll get that tax advantage.
How about a health savings account? We opened one, I did, and then my wife did a couple years ago. They have been terrific because they really help us to control our health costs.
Yeah, a health savings account with some high deductible health insurance is wonderful. If you're healthy, and if you're relatively healthy, it will be a much cheaper way of paying for your health care. People forget that they can just pay the doctor. It's amazing. The minute the government tries to take something over, they forget that you could have gotten it on your own, perhaps much cheaper than you could have through insurance. And with all of the insurance and Medicare and Medicaid and all of that, that's the government model of health care. Health savings plans is the private model of health care. And for 95% of the people, it's a good idea. The other 5% are the reason why health care costs are going up, and you don't want to be in the same pool with them. So it's just like education. We forget that you can get education privately. And if we had private schools and a voucher system, you'd get a much better education for a lower cost.
and we can only hope for the day. David Morata, thank you for joining us today, shedding some light on the topic. I would encourage people to visit you online at emorata.com, and we'll look forward to the next visit.
Thank you very much.
All righty.